Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. I had a referral from one of my good friends who I really respect, who said I should really talk to this guy. He knows a ton about finance and history. His name is Terry Curtis, and he should come onto the show and give his perspective on what's going on. And so I invited Terry Curtis onto the show to give us his perspective on where the United States is at, how it compares to China and the rest of the world. And I got to tell you, it was a very engaging conversation. So for those of you that don't like me talking, this is a conversation. And he really brought me out. I usually try to bring people out, and that's why I have a conversation with people, is to get them feeling comfortable and bring them out. He brought me out. And it was a really engaging conversation that I had with him about finance, economics, history. And I hope you enjoy this. Give it a little time, and I'd love to hear your comments on it. And maybe you can engage in the conversation as well. And try to be respectful, please. I mean, if all you're going to do is insult everybody, then just go comment somewhere else. But, you know, hearing different people's opinions and getting insight is a positive, good thing. And I'm hoping our forum can be something where smart, intelligent people can come together and have great debate and talk about things that are really important. So commenting is wonderful, but leave out the preschool or the middle school comments, and try to participate. So we're going to get right into that interview now with Terry Curtis. Hi, Terry. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You have been referred very strongly for someone that really understands international finance and the history of finance and how that ties in. And with the world so chaotic right now, and I think that's kind of an understatement, I'm hoping that you can shed some light on what's going on. So let's start off with, how would you characterize the shape of the U.S. economy right now?
I think the U.S. economy is actually going through a transformation today, and it's geopolitical, it's economic, and it's financial. I think that the United States hasn't truly emerged from the financial crisis 2008 just yet, and is still grappling with this. We've had a number of military conflicts that have added to the debt of the United States and have put more pressure on our treasury. And so at this juncture, it's going to take us at least another 10 years to climb out of let's call it a hole that the United States finds itself in economically as a result of the military conflicts and the financial crisis of 2008. And although it's 10 years ago, that financial crisis still resonates today. And maybe we'll get into a little bit with the income inequalities as an example of what the result of the financial crisis may have been.
Well, with the debt being so high, like MIT and other organizations have calculated that just mathematically we can't handle it. We have to do a reset of some sort because we just can't, it can't, you know, with printing so many dollars, it goes into infinity. And, you know, how do we deal with that without a reset and one that is maybe worldwide?
I think there will be a reset. I think there'll be a correction, maybe not a recession, but there certainly will be a correction over the next 18 to 24 months, in my opinion. Now, is that a 5% or 10% correction? That I'm not sure of.
So you're just seeing a correction with the market. I'm like a reset with the dollar.
It's actually tough to reset the dollar because the dollar is a free float.
But what do you do if the value of it goes off to almost nothing, you know, infinitively nothing, and the mathematical formula is like it just doesn't work?
I'm not sure if we'll actually hit that boundary, but don't forget, what backs the dollar today is the full faith and pledge of the United States economy as a whole. And it's still it's still the number one economy in some measures, and certainly number two economy in other measures, but clearly nearly double, numbers 3, 4, and 5. Okay. And so the United States is still a powerful instrument or an engine of innovativeness and economic, 2%, 3% economic growth is a singularly large number when you see that growth happen. And so there's a number of things that we need to address, I agree, but the United States is still a way off from having to do something as dramatic as a reset of the dollar. That's going to take a lot of political will to reset the U.S. dollar.
Again, I can imagine,
Because, I mean, back in the days of Nixon, the dollar was decoupled from the gold standard, if you recall, from the 1973 Brentwood Accords. And so now there is no longer gold backing the value of the dollar. So it's not tied to any hard asset. It's only tied to the ability of the United States to keep generating economic growth.
So basically, you can almost go on forever until the political will is to, because it's an illusion. It's illusionary.
It is illusory, for sure. And I agree with you on that point. But by the same token, the other let's call it the major currencies of which the United States dollar will battle against. There's the euro, okay, there's the British pound, and there's the Chinese yuan, more commonly known as the renminbi. Okay, the renminbi is a pegged currency, and it's set, by central policy, central control in China to the U.S. dollar. The euro is having its set of problems with respect to the refugee crisis in Europe and the number of areas within Europe that are looking to break away. I mean, just this last week, there's a referendum in Spain where Catalan want to separate from Spain. And they're not the only region, by the way. There's also the Ligue de Lombard, which is the northern part of Italy, has also considered separating from Italy. So you've got a European currency that's being backstopped by very disparate dissonant economies, beginning because the United Kingdom is still in the EU at this moment, all the way from the United Kingdom, which is a very strong economy, and Germany, very strong economies, all the way down to Greece, Ireland, Italy, which are very poor and weak economies. So if you look at the currency in which, and let's call them investors, because it's basically a currency, it is a commodity instrument. If you look at where investors actually want to put their investments, you've only got three or four or five currency choices of any note that are widely traded and relatively transparent. You got the British pound, you got the euro, you got the U.S. dollar, you got the Japanese yen, you got the Chinese renminbi.
Well, isn't there a battle going on who can control the world currency?
There is, but the dollar is still the standard. I mean, dollar backstops, all oil is quoted in dollars.
And I don't want to cut you off here, but because the oil is backing the dollar, are we tied to that energy source? I mean, is the whole world being tied to the oil energy source and not being able to move on from oil without the dollar collapsing?
Yes, but I think it's not because the dollar is tied to we are a petro economy in the world, and we rely on oil until we actually find an alternative fuel source. We'll always be tied to oil. It's just that the United States has such a big investment in the Middle East, backstopping Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and others, that the U.S. dollar is how oil is actually priced.
Okay. Would we have any incentive to find another source of energy if our dollar is backed by oil?
I think we will, because the OPEC nations and others use the dollar, but they can theoretically switch to another currency and price their oil in another currency, of which there's only two there's only two of which they're likely to choose from: the British pound or the euro.
What about the Chinese?
The currency is pegged. It's not a free flow currency, so there's risks involved with that. It could go in that direction. I see the Chinese less centered around using its currency as a worldwide standard currency for pricing of things like oil. I think the Chinese have taken a different route towards their economic growth, and we can get into that a little bit later. But their massive and major investments are in Africa at the moment. They've made immense amount of investments in Africa, which is the last continent of growth if you take a look at what has happened in the last 50 years.
Well, let's get into that, because the rise of China is affecting the world. So you see China focusing on Africa. You don't see them as trying to be the world currency or trying to get away from the influence of the United States as much and have more of a Eastern bloc.
I don't think the Chinese see the currency as a means by which to become the number one economy and the number one superpower in the world. I think they see investments and big investments in emerging markets as a way to gain that upper hand on places like the United States. You know, my opinion is, you know, as long as the United States spends a disproportionate amount of money on military investments and conducting wars, that just bleeds our treasury. And they're putting more money into the military, but they're not nearly as aggressive as the United States has been in the last 20 years. And so they've taken, you know, their limited, because everybody has a limited set of resources. You know, we can call it currency, but in effect, it's a limited amount of resources. And they're investing, you know, their money, their brain power, and their, you know, let's call it innovation, into emerging markets like Nigeria, like Kenya, some of the big countries in Africa who are rich with mineral wealth, and are markets that of, you know, 45 million people in Kenya, 190 million people in Nigeria.
So they're creating a smart foundation where we're spending all our money on military. We have bases all over the world, and we've increased our military spending, and we're doing a lot of black budget activities that could be used to help us out. So do you see us restructuring and being smarter with how we're using our resources? Or do you think we have this whole need to dominate the world militarily?
And this to be seen, you know, because it all depends on who's in power politically in the United States at any point in time. But, I mean, I did some numbers, you know, when we were preparing for this particular podcast. And the top 25 military defense contractors in the United States generate $250 billion of revenue off military spend. Okay. And so Eisenhower was correct when he said the United States has become a military industrial complex. And we haven't really gotten away from that.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious, right? But we're not. It's obvious that we're a military industrial complex and we have bases all over the world.
Absolutely.
And so much of our economy is based on that. But the thing that scares me is that we have a lot of suffering people everywhere, you know, all these suicides from the military and everything else, that we're not looking at red flags and we're just keep marching towards this military front. And the red flags are our big competitors like China are working on solid foundations, and we're not caring about solid foundations, whether it's our money or it's our community's health.
I mean, to be honest, I absolutely agree with you, to be quite truthful. We don't take care of our military personnel when they come back from an Afghanistan or an Iraq. And this is something that we need to put more money into. And it's interesting to see let me back up a little bit.
Sure.
There's a number of issues going on. You can put China aside for a second. There was a number of issues going on just for the United States alone, and who has taken control of the government from my perspective. You know, big money and lobbyists pretty much control what goes on. And access to our politicians is at the lowest level in, you know, from the beginning of the Constitution. I did a calculation the other day. When the Constitution was adopted in, I think it was 1797, 1792, somewhere in the last decade of the 18th century, the population of the United States was roughly 3.5 million people. Okay, and in the Constitution says that there should be 435 members of the House of Representatives as part of Congress, and the Senate was a compromise because of small, big states. So if you do the math, back then, and about 500,000 people were slaves. They, you know, weren't considered to be citizens. Okay, so it's basically 3 million people. Each representative in the Constitution represented roughly 7,000 people. Okay. Today, there's roughly 330 million people in the United States. Okay, so each representative now represents something like nearly a million people. Think about how the access to your representative has changed. With your voice, you're one of a million versus one of 7,000 from the time the Constitution was adopted, and how they looked at the because the House of Representatives is what we call the lower body.
Even think we have any access. I mean, I and the
that's the point. That's exactly the point.
The facts that come out is that it doesn't matter what the people think. They go in whatever direction they want anyways, and both parties tend to go in the same direction.
Absolutely. There's no real difference between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, in my opinion. But I think it's because of big money buys elections today. But if we were to increase the House representatives from the current 435, and I don't believe in big government, but I believe in representative government. If we were to actually increase the House representatives to be more proportionate to what the founders of the country thought about with representation, we would have something in the neighborhood of 4,000 to 5,000 representatives.
Well, and that would be a nightmare too to manage. It's almost like we need to be. And I don't want to, go there necessarily, but it's almost like we need to be broken up just to be manageable. Just kind of like this big bureaucracy in a company, you start breaking up companies so that they're more manageable.
You've got a very good point, actually. You've got a very good point, because there are portions of the United States that are driven by different economic factors. I mean, California itself is almost as large as Spain. In terms of population. And you've got Texas, you've got Florida, you've got the Northeast United States, you've got the Midwest. If you take, you're from Minnesota in Illinois, you're really talking, what would be considered to, I mean, China's got the same problem, by the way, 1.3 billion, but it's a centralized economy. So it's much easier to handle. So when you have a much larger population and you got disparate views on how things should be run, a democracy is very messy. It's extremely messy.
It's hard. Yeah. So, China can work because they're communist and they're a dictatorship, sort in a way.
Exactly.
They make it work because you have to do. But if you're going to do democracy, you have it work and actually represent the people. It needs to be more representation, and because they don't do what we want anyway. So what do we have right now? We have a corporate fascist system who run everything.
Yes, I mean we got
without any intelligence. I mean, there's no like organized intelligence. It's all based on them making money versus what's best for society and how we should move forward.
Absolutely. And that's my point about actually increasing the representatives by a factor of tenfold, because now corporations have to spend a hell of a lot more money to actually sway government. And their lobbying efforts will cost them a factor of 10 to 100 times more to get what they get today for a lot less money.
And they wouldn't be able to do that. That would be a good thing, but I don't know if that would work either. Nightmare to get something done is so hard. So how long do you think, are we going to have a collapse at some point, or how long can they go and kick the can down the road and us not actually doing anything about anything? Go ahead.
It's a very interesting question. I mean, we've been kicking the can down the road since the late 60s. So we've been able to do this. And I think that the inflection point will be when the United States economy hits number two or number three or number four. And we will go through the same kind of transformation, a bad transformation, that the United Kingdom went through in the 50s. I mean, if you take a look at it, every major empire, and we're an empire, doesn't last forever. And sometimes they go down slowly, but most of the time they go down with a bang. Look at Rome in the 6th century A.D. Look at the United Kingdom after World War I, between World War I and World War II. You can go down the Qing Dynasty.
Well, explain it. Let's use some examples. Like the United Kingdom, when it went down after World War II, because one of the stats that you said was 70% of the time when an empire falls, it leads to major war.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, one of the books that I've been reading by Alison Graham called Destined for War, and he looks at Thucydides' Trap, mm-hmm. which actually looked at the Peloponnesian War, when Athens was a rising area or let's call it empire, butting up against Sparta, and they went to war. Okay, and this is how Sparta was the dominant empire, and Athens on the Greek islands was the rising empire. And Athens, they went to war, and Athens actually won that war and went on to become cradle of civilization. But in the last 500 years, there's actually been, I think they said something, and I'm just looking at my notes if you don't mind, there's been 16 major changes in terms of a dominant empire being displaced by a rising empire. In 12 of those 16 cases, they've been the rising empire displaced the dominant empire via war. And so this book talks about, you know, can China become the dominant empire rising against the superpower United States and avoid a conflict?
Well, but it's not even possible for them to do a military conflict, right? So maybe we're talking a different type of conflict.
I mean, it could be a different type of conflict. It may not be an extremely hot war because you have, you know, nuclear weapons and so forth. But, I mean, nobody thought that World War II would happen. And 55 million people lost their lives in World War II. So, and we've got one factor that's taking place between the United States and China called North Korea. So with the North Korea in the mix, we're a lot more likely to have a conflict, a hot war with China through a proxy war in North Korea than maybe a couple of years ago when we thought about, you know, China rising. Now, having said that,
yeah, because North Korea the whole thing's kind of a farce, right? I mean, it's a front for a war with China.
Yes, I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, as long as the United States is spending more money on military, actually, supporting South Korea, threatening North Korea, that's just more of our treasury spent on military and less of our treasury spent on infrastructure and education. So both the Chinese and the Russians, as a matter of fact, like this kind of conflict. They, you know, this helps them to do what they need to do internally while the United States spends its money. Because every time we sent the 7th Fleet somewhere, it costs money to send that 7th Fleet.
That's what we did to Russia. We caused them to spend themselves out of oblivion.
That's exactly what we did to Russia.
And now they're all going to try to do that to us, which we're doing it to ourselves.
We're falling into that trap.
Well, they don't even have to do much. Well, we're signing up for it without much pressure.
With the current administration, we seem to be signing up for that. But hopefully, cooler heads will prevail. We still a democracy. I mean, the part of the thing that Yeah, I mean,
because I never listen to the people anyways. So
no, again, I'm going back to my original. I mean, I'd love to see the House representatives increase by tenfold because, again, I mean, I have a much better chance of talking to my representative when I'm one of 7,000 than when I'm one of 1,000,000.
Well, but then you could create a different structure where it was maybe another hierarchy or something, which would be like nation states to a bigger part, almost like, well, we don't want to be like the Europe, you know, like the Euro, but almost like that so that we can have better representation.
Well, and then you bring up a very good point. There could be blocks or regions that aligned in the United States that have, similarities, synergies, and commonalities, like the Northeast region, which is based on finance and technology, California, which is almost a region of its own. You got the Western region, you know, east of California, but west of the Mississippi. You got the Southern region, which has its own set of economic dynamics. I mean, that could possibly happen, you know, like a loose federation. I don't know how we'd accomplish something like that without, you know, going through our own internal conflict. But that's one way to look at it.
Yeah, it'd be a nightmare.
But I think the point's well taken. The point being is how do we as people, as citizens of the United States, get the representation, you know, in government that we truly deserve? And that's getting harder and harder and harder to achieve and harder to accomplish. And so, I mean, if you've got billions and you're part of the top 1%, you've got power and influence. And that concentration of wealth is happening at a much higher rate. I think we spoke earlier on a different conversation in which we've never seen a concentration of wealth where 29% of all income and wealth in the United States is concentrated in the top 1%. Okay, the last time we've seen a concentration like this was in 1929, just before the crash. Which is interesting.
Well, the other thing, there was a UN report done about 15 years ago where it said when the concentration of wealth is in the top, I don't remember the exact stat, in the top 25%, the top 25% have, I don't know, 80% of the wealth and the bottom percent have less than 5%. There was some stat.
Yeah, this is that it pretty much falls into the 80-20 rule where the top 20% control 80% of the wealth. And the bottom 80% control 20% of wealth. And I think that's what you're referring to. And
yeah, it must have been that one, yeah. And then it always leads to revolution.
Yeah, I mean, actually, we're seeing that today. Right now, we're seeing a backlash through Black Lives Matter and other groups, with civil unrest. And so we've characterized it as kind of a race issue. But when you get right down to it, it really is a wealth disparity issue. because they, you know, I mean, there's a book by Matt Taibbi called The Divide. It's actually a good book for people to read about what goes on. I mean, there's been no banker, from the financial crisis ever convicted of a crime.
Yeah, that's absolutely shameful.
A shame.
Well, there has been one.
The Chinese.
Yes. There was a documentary done about that one.
A very good documentary. And they weren't convicted because they actually self-reported when they discovered.
They were the honest ones.
They were the honest one.
And they were attacked. Go ahead.
And the U.S. government and the Justice Department went after them because they were small. They don't go after Goldman Sachs. They don't go after J.P. Morgan. I mean, but you know, they'll go after this bank. The bank was called Abacus, by the way. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly.
People can search for it. It was Frontline, I think, right?
Frontline did a very good documentary on it. And if people want to get some more detail on it, they can read the book by Matt Taibbi called The Divide, which is a lot more social injustice that goes on based on his point of view. Now, he's a bit left-leaning, and I would admittedly say I'm a bit left-leaning myself. So, but, I mean, there clearly is two United States today. The haves, the have-nots, and there's a much bigger pool of have-nots. And as you stated a minute ago, where will this lead? And I do believe it's already beginning to lead to civil unrest.
Well, the problem, though, is that a lot of the people on the right are also the have-nots. And that's why there's
That so interesting? Mm-hmm. That is amazingly. There was a book, and I can't remember the author, Whatever Happened to Kansas, which talks specifically to how people vote themselves into poverty, by the Republican attitude of, little government, which is another fallacy, by the way. If you take a look at every great movement in the United States over the past 300 years, government has played in a major role in that movement. And I'll go back to early on.
Yeah, but you can see why they don't want more government when you have a fascist direction with our government and you have military all over the world. We want smarter government that's out of our lives when they shouldn't be, when they shouldn't be in our lives.
It's absolutely true. I mean, we should have less government. But I'm talking, I'm going to separate it between the social aspects and the economic aspects.
Okay.
The social aspects, government has no rights, no business being in the social aspects of our lives. Absolutely agree with that. But the economic aspects in terms of, big movements in the United States, I'm talking about really big transformational movements in the United States, government has always been involved. Go back to where the United States tripled in size in, the year was 1805, I think maybe, where Thomas Jefferson had the Louisiana Purchase. The United States tripled in size. That's the federal government buying from Napoleon all the territory west, up to the Mississippi, okay? Think about that. That tripled the size of the United States at that time.
Although I have a beef with that part of our country is almost all federally owned.
True, but it's also federally paid for. Okay, but
I know it just goes against our freedom initiative and everything.
Well, you're talking about further west of the Mississippi, where there's and that was part of what Teddy Roosevelt did, nationalizing parks like Yosemite and so forth.
That whole process and the fact that. That's why I have a hard time knowing what I am. I am really hardcore independent because as I get into these issues, I realize that none of this really aligns with the whole left-right paradigm is a joke.
It is a joke.
And I've talked to some ranchers. Actually, I'm working on getting a family to come onto the show and it's taking some time. But I've heard that 79 ranchers in that Oregon area have been forced off their land by the federal government, and the government's taken it over. And the problem is that they've been flooded out and things like that. The problem is when the federal government gets that much power and you get somebody in place who's kind of a psychopathic, they don't care about the people, and maybe that gets back to your representative government. They do things that are just awful. And again, maybe that comes back to representative government. We don't have any.
I mean, if you think about, this is where I talk about representative government of 4,000 to 5,000 representatives versus big government. The problem is you've got bureaucrats that are in the federal government that have lifetime jobs in the federal government that don't answer to no one.
They're like little kings of their own little kingdoms. Yeah,
and you see that, you see a lot. So where the Republicans, or let's call it the right-leaning people, talk about getting big government out, that's the kind of government that, you know, they have to really rein in a government like that. And I absolutely agree with that. Absolutely agree with that. But there is a role. I mean, if you take a look, and I'll go back to the big growth. I mean, because you're right. In the Western states, there clearly was a lot of federal intrusion on private land owners. But Thomas Jefferson actually purchased, you know, for, you know, what ended up being a very cheap price, the Louisiana Purchase, which, you know, which was the start of the United States, you know, on its way to empire. Okay.
Yeah.
That purchase,
yeah.
The federal government doesn't purchase that, doesn't happen. There's the United States empire moving towards coast to coast.
The other reason that I heard that made sense to me, I was talking to Cynthia McKinney in an interview, and she was saying, and this gave me, this was a light for me, on why the black community is so interested in having the government involved. And that's because all through history, the government was the organization, or was there the only way they could get things accomplished. The government had to force it. And that's how they got most of their freedoms. And that's their perspective on it. Obviously, freedom would have happened naturally without a civil war, and civil war wasn't really based on slavery, and there's all that BS behind that. But throughout, you know, even the Civil Rights Amendment, and you can even say all that stuff is BS, but from the perspective, the government had to step in for them not to be abused. And so their perspective is now they're seeing the government differently, because now the government is part of the abuse with the prison system and stuff. But so...
The privatization of prison system. You're going to think about, once you privatize the prison system, what do you rely on? You rely on more prisoners in order to make more money.
It's the wrong time. It's not a free market. People think all you have to do is privatize something, it's suddenly free market. That's not free.
Yeah,
free market
that's not a free
isn't
market.
Just because you privatize something.
No,
free market's its own. Yeah.
Privatize, taking a social issue and privatizing that around monetization is not a free market. Okay.
It is not a free market. They're
in total conflict. I mean, the prison system should be a part of the government, because, you know, and I mean, we get into the whole conversation about that.
Well, we're doing that with our children, with the children's welfare system as well. And we have one big nightmare going on there, too.
Yeah, I mean.
Because the free market conditions aren't at work, because the client, which is the child or the prisoner, have absolutely no say.
No,
this is what work.
That's the misnomer. The child and the prisoner are not clients. They're the raw material for making money.
Yeah, they're not.
That's the difference.
So there's no buyer pressure.
No, there's none.
That keeps them on. Yeah, which is in a free market. You need that, and you need the competition, and none of that exists.
And it doesn't exist. It just doesn't exist.
And so it doesn't work. Yeah.
I mean,
they use that argument to, you know, the privatization for smaller government, all this other crap, free market. If you ever hear, listeners, if you ever hear that argument, it's all BS.
That's a red flag. That's a red flag. It's nothing to do with it. That's private companies finding a way into the government to the government fund, because it's guaranteed money. Okay, so it's not free market. That privatization just means I now have an inside track to getting government funding. That's all that means.
It's more fascism. It's more.
It's pigs at a trough.
Yes, it is. It's as gross as it gets.
It really is. But just go back for a second into, we're talking about things about the United States and what we can do to turn around. And again, and give me the example. We never got past the Louisiana Purchase, which is the first example, but there was many other better examples, like the internet. Without the DARPANET and the U.S. government, the U.S. military investing into connecting the military with universities and colleges, there'd be no backbone, which is now the World Wide Web.
Yeah, I mean,
that's
I would
just
agree
a given.
With that.
The other example is the federal highway system, you know, which was actually a bill passed under Eisenhower, Republican administration. If we don't have the interstate highway system built by the federal government, the auto industry would not be as strong as it was in the 50s and 60s. It just wouldn't exist, because it literally increased the number of roads by a factor of 10 to 100 fold.
And
so
they
now
will do things like, if you just say, well, the private organization, but the privates won't, they'll only do what they need, which would be limited, and it wouldn't work for the whole infrastructure.
Exactly. They will only do what will maximize shareholder wealth. They will not do what will maximize social wealth. There's a big difference between shareholder wealth and social wealth. You know, in companies today have shifted dramatically towards shareholder wealth maximization, which is what we're seeing today in the high concentration of wealth in just a very small segment of the population, because most people don't own stocks. And so when you take a look at, you know, where this wealth is coming from, that wealth is coming from shareholder wealth maximization on publicly traded corporations as one vehicle by which people, you know, gain immense wealth. I think we talked about this a little bit the other day, where if you take a look at what they call the median middle income families back in 1983, if you could actually compare the median middle income family to the upper income family, okay, the upper income family was 3.4 times as wealthy as a middle income family. In 2013, that number was up 6.6 times. It's doubled. In 20 years, it's doubled. And so if you look at the numbers today, a upper income, you know, and I'm not sure how much you make, but what's considered to be upper income now is $694,000 a year. Okay. And median middle income is $94,000 a year. That's the disparity, as you know, and this is, it's not just the poor. It's also the eroding middle class, which is a bit, in my mind, there's always going to be an impoverished segment of your population. But our middle class is shrinking at an alarming rate. And so now we're having what is essentially poor or relatively poor and rich and relatively rich, as opposed to poor, a robust middle class, and a smaller, you know, but wealthy upper class. And this is what's you know, the middle class is eroding. They're either getting rich, those lucky enough, or they're falling into an impoverished state. And this is where I agree with you, that that's going to cause more and more unrest. And we're seeing this unrest not as a social dilemma, but as a race dilemma, which is masking the real problem.
So it's BS.
It's BS.
Well, I think it's, and do you think that's on purpose? Do you think they're purposely recasting it as a race thing so that it takes the heat off other people?
I think you're right. I think they're recasting it. I mean, it's statistically proven that people of color, you know, are more likely to be in the bottom economic strata than people, you know, white people. I mean, so that it truly exists. But I think you're right. I think that creates a good opportunity to recast this as a race issue as opposed to a socioeconomic issue.
And all Absolutely it does great. By casting things as racial issues all the time, all it does is hurt the people that. All it does is hurt the black community to always cast it like that.
Yes,
because now they're always victims, and God, you got to get out of that victim status in order to get past that.
True. But if you go back to the 1800s, I mean, it wasn't black versus white; it was English versus Irish. Mm-hmm. I mean, so there's always been that cast, whether it be race or ethnicity. There's always been that, you know, have those groups fight. Okay. At the time, it was the Irish fighting the Italians in the 50s, you know, for these blue collar jobs. You know, okay. And so now we've just progressed into black white versus Irish.
Yeah, but the reason why I hate the black white is because the blacks really have suffered throughout history.
No,
and we got to get them out of this victim mentality. I mean, otherwise, they'll just keep suffering, and they deserve more than that. So they deserve more than our left media casting them as victims all the time.
No, I absolutely agree.
They
The African American community is a special case. Absolutely agree. And so, I mean, they've had a unique role, a unique road in American history, for sure. And there was a number of different government initiatives to help the, let's call it, the black community, brown community. The biggest initiative was in the 60s with Lyndon Baines Johnson's Great Society. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that proved to be a monumental failure. And so I don't know the answer to that, because I have a tendency to look at helping groups of individuals through education and economics as opposed through government subsidy. But government has a role to play in this. I mean, I think our education system is poor today.
Our education system is falling off a cliff. We have extreme good, and then we
Absolutely.
Have a sea of crap.
Right, and there's a reason for that too. If you go back to the U.S. public education, the United States is the first country in the world to have public education. I was just looking at some statistics. I mean, the first public school in the United States is actually here in Boston, called Boston Latin School, opened in 1639 and still operates today. The first public subsidized school in the United States was in Dorchester, Massachusetts, called the Mather School. Okay, and so over the course of, you know, New England was in the forefront of public education, but it quickly spread to the rest of the United States. And at the time that we actually developed the public school system, we were basically an agrarian society. Okay, and so this is why most school systems are subsidized for real estate taxes. Okay, but over the, and it's still subsidized by real estate taxes. I mean, I live in a city called Westboro, Massachusetts. It's got one of the top 50 school districts in the United States, and my real estate taxes are high, but I don't mind paying it because I had two children going through the school system here. But as the country changed from an agrarian to industrial to technological society, the funding of our public schools didn't shift along with it. And so I'm a proponent that it should be a government corporate initiative to finance a public school, because who benefits from a well-educated workforce?
But don't we outfund every other country in the world? I mean, so we have we just are a mess.
I think there's a number of issues. I think I'm not sure if we, I think we do, as a matter
we
of fact.
We do. We don't fund everybody, but it gets back to the whole mess where unions and lobbyists and all the other bullshit.
Oh, that's the other thing. I mean, you've got a number of different
issues. Pardon my language. It's the first time I've sworn on air. Go ahead.
I do that to people. I like talking about.
You're bringing me out. I'm supposed to do that to you.
You don't have to. I don't think you want to do that, because that can be extremely vocal. But I think you're right. I mean, there are a number of different constituents. Let's call them constituents, for lack of a more polite term, that are vying for dollars. You know, they're vying for money, and they come up with different schemes to try to use, you know, government money, whether it be local municipality or federal government money, to try different programs. Okay, and we've outspent on education, and then you've got the labor unions, where it's not a meritocracy. It's, you know, I'm in a labor union and teachers union. But the other things too, I mean, kids go to school, I think on average 160 days a year in the United States, where other countries, the children go to school upwards of 200, 250 days a year. Think about that for a second, you know, and we pay teachers full time. And, you know, but the other thing too, we get less credible teachers because Wall Street has sucked our mathematicians, has sucked.
We'd have no respect for teaching.
We have zero respect for it. I mean,
no respect.
You know, zero respect for, you know, I mean.
And those should be our most valued. I mean.
And in places like China, it is revered. A teacher is revered. Here in the United States, a teacher is not revered. It's a stepping stone. It is a stepping stone to something else.
Wouldn't you say, now getting back to the China thing, wouldn't you say, because they're so focused on a lot of the right foundational elements that a society needs and they're investing, that it's just a matter of time before we are, you know, what do you see as the future with us having military all over the world and just crumbling everywhere? What's going to happen?
I think we're going to end up like the United Kingdom in the 1950s, if you ask me.
And what would you characterize that as?
As a second-rate empire declining on the way down and needing the handout of another superpower in order to stay buoyant. The United States subsidized Great Britain after World War II.
Well, who's going to subsidize us? And if we don't get subsidized, what happens?
The Chinese will subsidize us because we owe the Chinese a lot of money. We owe the Chinese something like $2 trillion in debt.
So we will be at the mercy of the Chinese, you think?
Yes. I mean, unless we do make some dramatic change in the next 10 years, I truly believe that. I mean, I think there's not a superpower on the planet that has ever lasted forever. I mean, it's like any life cycle. I mean, you reach a maturity stage, and I mean, you start to really exhaust. You know, it's not too different than an aging person. You get to 70 years old. I mean, you've pretty much depleted your own anatomical resource. And the United States is going to go through that same cycle. I mean, it's inevitable. The question is, you know, we don't have to do it fast. We can actually prolong it so that we, you know, we stay buoyant for a while longer. But I think the moves that we're making today are not helping us to stay buyant for longer.
But and then what the happens question, to all our military? I mean, we have – it's not just a matter of us going down. I mean, we have very sophisticated military and arms and things that can destroy the world. Everywhere.
We don't,
you know, I mean it's not something that is safely taken down.
No, it's not.
It's a complex problem.
I mean, in Russia, but we have an example that we can study in the complex problem, because with the breakup of the Soviet Union had the same issue. I mean, they had the same issue we have if we encounter the same issue. You've got nuclear weapons in Ukraine. You've got nuclear weapons in Belarus. You've got Russia now emerging itself. And they had a very big military presence worldwide. It just happened to be in a contiguous landmass that's like, you know, three times the size of the United States, but it was still an empire.
But wouldn't you say that they're falling, which was something we can study for sure, to make sure that we can safeguard the world, is still a fraction of the mess we have now, because it is 40 years more of technology, or 30 years more of advanced technology.
Yes, I on that aspect, I do agree with you. But I mean, if you think about it, I mean, we just increased, there was a budget proposed to Congress that was more than the actual military were asking for. We spent a disproportionate amount of money on military. I mean, there's a whole set of factors for that. You got Raytheon, you got ITT, you've got Rockwell, you've got GE. The military industrial complex, I mean, the top 25 military contractors generate $250 billion in revenue. And I can imagine the other follow-on companies that are contractors for these companies. I'm betting it's about $1 trillion in revenue. Yes. And so this is the problem.
So now what will happen? When this whole thing, will there be a big event, or would it just be are you predicting like civil unrest, which will trigger a big event, or do you just kind of like a slow decline to China taking over?
I think it's going to be a slow decline. I don't think it'll be a catastrophic event or a schism, you know, of an earthquake type magnitude. I think it'll just be a slow decline. Now, what can happen that can be positive, that you can turn this around, if you take that trillion in military spend, you know, or revenue generated by military contractors, and put it into our own infrastructure and education, I mean, this is where we can actually start to turn things around. I mean, I used to live in Minneapolis, where you live, in that region for a while, and I live in the Northeast now. And Boston is, you know, a little better infrastructure. But if you drive 25, 30 minutes, or you go down to New Jersey, the infrastructure is in complete and utter disarray and in decay. And President Obama said it, and even President Trump said, "I want to spend $1 trillion in infrastructure." Okay,
that was one of his campaign.
Exactly,
and that was when he wanted to focus on our infrastructure,
and that's the right thing to focus on, because it is American jobs. Okay, it's going to call for education, it's a call for spend in the United States, it's something that's actually going to help the economy of the United States. But yet we don't seem to be able to find the political willpower because of the lobbying efforts, because, as you said early in this conversation, where the left and the right are really the same party, and they're beholden to the Goldman Sachs of the world, the J.P. Morgans of the world, and other special interests of the world, that this won't happen. But if the United States were to take $1 trillion, to think about the job creation in the United States, because you can't export this.
Well, the bailouts that we did and what the Federal Reserve was doing when they audited the Federal Reserve and the money that was going everywhere. And if they just did that to the people, they could have bailed out every mortgage in the country.
Absolutely.
I just think there could have been a better solution where we would be really on track right now.
I think there'd be a much, much more effective solution. But the problem you have, you know, the decision makers that actually prepare the TARP, which is the Federal Relief Program, toxic asset. I mean, those assets weren't toxic. They created toxic assets. If you take a look at the decision makers, what's his name? Paulson. Paulson, who was the head of Treasury.
He was a Sachs guy.
CEO of Goldman Sachs. Yeah. Okay. Look at Geithner, who's beholden to Robert Rubin. You know, all these individuals that made these decisions are coming from, you know, the very industry that caused the problem and the very industry that received the relief. There's actually a pretty good sized regional bank in your neck of the woods. I think it's TD Bankworth. I think it is. I will think of the name of the bank. I'm sorry, is this flipping my
name? Yeah, it's not that. But
yeah. Yeah, he's a true commercial lender. Okay. And they were not in trouble at all. He said, you know, people taking a wide brush against bankers.
Oh, yes. Okay? Yes.
But in fact, the cause of the financial crisis were the investment banks, not the commercial banks. Mm-hmm. And Bank of America at the time and Citi were investment banks. Okay, but we look at them as commercial banks. Many super regional banks around the country were sound and still lending. So we actually bailed out. We bailed out casinos is what we bailed out.
But we still have the problem, but even worse today.
We have a huge problem. The too big to fail is now even bigger.
Well, but in 2008 collapse almost happened. Can't that almost happen again?
Yeah, and it's going to be in student loans, by the way. It'll be in, you know, look at the student loans.
We don't have the ability to bail out anymore, do we?
No, we...
So could that be the trigger of a
Now, if something like that... I'm assuming that a major catastrophe of that nature doesn't occur, but you're right. If something like that happens again, I don't think... It's going to be very tough for us to actually pull together the kind of money it'll take to buy our way out of the problem, which is what we did with TARP.
Well, and we're still in that major situation.
And we're still very tentative. It's still very tentative. There was a person, he was part of the Department of Justice up in New York and actually took on the role as auditor or cop. He was in charge of watching to see how the TARP money is spent. Okay, and he wrote an extremely enlightening book called Bailout. His name is Neil Barofsky. I would suggest that people read that book. It would demonstrate to people just how mismanaged the TARP monies. It's an amazing book.
But how can we continue mismanaging to this level and not collapse? I mean, at some point, you just anybody, you know.
I don't think it's mismanagement. I think it's purposely done.
No, why do you say that's purposely done? That's interesting.
Because I think that there is special interests that will gain from the system, and I think that we're not talking about small money, we're talking about big money, and those special interests see that money as something that can be taken.
Now,
and
do
so,
you see it as a purposeful to destroy the United States?
I don't see it as purposeful to destroy the United States. I see it purposeful as greed.
Greed and stealing and corruption.
Exactly. And, they're not purposefully thinking about destroying the United States. They're purposefully thinking about enriching themselves.
Mm-hmm. But that's the problem without having representation and a government that's out of control.
Exactly. And this brings me back to, I know it's not something you like too much, but this brings me back to, I'd rather have far more House of Representative members than we have today, because it's like concentration of wealth. I got a concentration of people that I can actually talk to and lobby and fund their campaigns. I'm going to get their attention a lot more likely than a person who just goes and votes.
Well, I know I've been talking to people about self-determination, people that have been researching how to do that, and people's how to set up your own society. There's a lot of chatter about how to create nation states and how to change the structure of the United States because of this problem.
Yeah, and now, see, and I'm not a proponent of doing this outside the system. I'm a proponent of doing this within the system. There's a difference between me and some other people.
Sure.
This great experiment called the Republic has been one of the most successful experiments in the history of mankind.
Yes. Freedom and respect, but there's a point where what the heck's going on and how do we get this back? But I'm sorry, keep going.
No, you're right. You're absolutely correct. And this is the point where, this is where I start to think about, this is not the way it's happening. It makes me uncomfortable. Like we had, I 100% agree with you. I don't think there's much difference between Republicans and Democrats. President Obama had more drone attacks, something like 10 times the amount of drone attacks than were conducted by George Bush.
Well, and Obama had more persecution of journalists than any other, than all presidents combined.
And I'm telling you, I'm more of a Democrat than a Republican. I actually voted for President Obama twice, okay? But I was completely disappointed in how he completely fell into. We had a chance to actually stand up for the American and actually prosecute the bankers, and he chose not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
He had a choice to appoint Paul Volcker, head of the Treasury, instead of Geithner, and he didn't. Paul Volcker was the Fed chairman at the time
That makes you wonder who they're beholden to,
Both parties are beholden to big money banks. Absolutely. There's no doubt in my mind. At least in my mind, there's no doubt.
Or whoever's behind those banks.
Oh, whoever's behind those banks. Exactly. I mean, there's a billionaire, there's a hedge fund, his name is Mercer, that's behind Trump. Okay, with the alt-right movement. Okay, and so what ends up becoming is I'm a Bernie Sanders fan. I'm a Bernie Sanders fan because he's like Trump, he's a populist. Okay, but he's a populist that wants to actually help those of us that don't have the, you know, a lot of my friends think I'm nuts, by the way. But
well, you're in the finance world, so you're probably at the opposite spectrum of a lot of.
Oh, I'm definitely at the opposite spectrum, but but I believe in representative government. I really believe in it, and a person like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren fight for those of us that don't have a voice in government.
Well, I know the Sanders group was a lot like the Trump group more than they realize.
They were very much so. They were a mirror image of one another, polar opposites, but mirror image.
Yes.
Both
well,
opposites.
Or more alike than they realize, too.
Yeah, very, very much so. I mean, it was a backlash. I mean, I'll go back again. I mean, to this day, I truly believe that if it was Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump for the presidency,
Sanders would have won.
I think Sanders would have won. There was no way Hillary Clinton, who's part of that, you know, lobbyist political crowd, was going to win this election.
It's well, just, Clinton wrecked it for Sanders, is what happened. That was the history of the story.
And Trump
got in because of the fight, the internal fight on the Democratic Party.
I absolutely agree. I mean, this was the first time which you see the citizens of the United States. You know, it's only once every 4 years that the citizens can actually voice their dismay with government. This is the first time that the citizens of the United States said, I'm not voting for, it's more of the same. And this is how we got Trump. I mean, I'm not a Trump supporter, but this is how we got Trump. They said, we're fed up with this.
Well, but I'm sorry, but Trump was a lot better than Hillary. The stuff I've heard about Hillary, I'm...
Yeah, I'm not. I mean,
you don't. Where this is, I know this isn't where you want to go, but I can't believe the stuff I heard about her, and she is not what she pretends to be.
Yeah, no, she's been again. She, Bush, Obama, mm-hmm. Clinton won. Even Trump is disappointing. I mean,
yes.
Look, he points to his cabinet, you know, Mnuchin. I mean, again, we're back to. Wall Street haves, filling in key posts in the cabinet. And so not much has changed. And
he's doing some stuff, but he's also doing things that are disappointing. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, but I don't know how you can go in, you know, to be fair to anyone, any president, I don't know how you can go in and completely do an agenda without having to do, you know, it's a mess over there. I mean, the swamp is so murky that I don't know.
It truly is. I mean, in my opinion, in the last 20 years, there have been two defining points in which a presidency could actually have changed how politics are conducted. The first was 9/11, okay, with the first kind of terrorist mm-hmm. attack on the U.S. soil. And Bush reacted like any Republican would react, to this day, Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. And so, why?
Well, and there's a lot of questions. There's a lot of questions on 9/11 that,
But that cost us $3 trillion. That war between, it says $3 trillion of our treasure gone, in that war. And then the second time was after the financial crisis when President Obama had the chance to, really put people in the cabinet that represented the people, and he chose to do the status quo.
And he didn't.
And that was my disappointment in him.
And that's what gets you back to who are really, and this is why people are really questioning things. Who's really leading this country? Who's really doing things? Who's really leading these banks? Because nobody seems to have power. Nobody does what they say they're going to do. And then they go in and the same people are, they never listen to the people. The same people are being put into power and nothing can ever be accomplished.
I mean, but when you think about it, the presidency, this last one, okay, and even the one before this, it cost $2 billion. Think about that. The presidency, the contest for the presidency of the United States was $2 billion each.
Mm-hmm.
Who's got that kind of money?
Well, yeah, it's all money.
I mean, that's where it comes. I mean, this should be limited. And our whole election cycle is just dramatically way too long. And I've heard pros and cons about, should it be or shouldn't be. For example, the United Kingdom's election cycle for their prime minister is something like 8 weeks.
Oh, that's good. Okay. we have way longer.
We've already begun to identify who frontrunners are for the next presidential cycle, which is like 3 years away. Think mm-hmm. about that.
Oh, it's a long horse race. Well, we have to wrap up because we don't have much more time, but how can people learn more about you and get in contact with you?
Well, they can reach me on Skype at ttcjr98, and they can reach me on my email address at ttcurtis.network@gmail.com. And I don't know if you give phone numbers, but I mean, they can
you might not want to, because there are going to be a lot of people that are going to hear you.
Yeah. So those are the two best ways to get in touch with me.
Okay, so email and so good. So I'll put that up on screen so people can have it, and I'll have it on the show page as well.
Perfect.
And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for inviting me.